Late in March of 1965, I was compelled to join 25,000 others from all corners of the United States who marched on the then bastion of bigotry, the then capital of corruption, Montgomery, Alabama. Though South Boston now holds undisputed title to the designation, Montgomery is still no flowerbed of racial sanity. But the myth of the liberal North sure got the hell shot out of it by the Southies from Irish redneck Boston. I was part of the human flood tide they called a freedom march that was trying to tell Governor George Wallace that Alabama was not an island, that it was part of the civilized universe, that though we came from New York and California and Illinois and South Dakota, we were not outside agitators, we were fellow human beings who shared the same grand faloon called Americans. And we were seeking dignity and civil rights for a people shamefully bludgeoned and mistreated for over two centuries. It was a walk through the country of the blind. I've written about it at length elsewhere. But now, it's 10 years later. And yesterday, a friend of mine's 65-year-old mother got mugged and robbed in broad daylight by two black girls. It's 10 years later, and a girl I once loved very deeply got raped repeatedly at knife point in the back seat of her own car in an empty lot behind a bowling alley in the San Fernando Valley by a black dude who kept at her for 7 hours. It's 10 years later, and Martin Luther King is dead, and Superfly is alive. And what am I to say to Doris Pitkin Buck, who lost her dear and magical Richard on the streets of Washington, D.C. to a pack of black killers who chose to stomp to death a man in his 80s for however much stash money he might have been carrying? Do I say to that friend of mine, when they went to drag the Mississippi swamps for the bodies of the civil rights workers, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, they dredged up the bodies of 16 black men who had been cavalierly murdered and dumped in the muck, and no one even gave a damn? The newspapers didn't even make much of a note of it, that it was the accepted way to handle an uppity nigger in the South. Do I say that and hope I've said something rational? Do I say to the girl that I loved, every time you see a mocha-colored maid or waitress, it means her great-great-grandmother was a sexual pincushion for some plantation massa? That rape and indentured bed service was taken for granted for 200 years, and if it was refused, there was always a stout length of cordwood to change the girl's thinking? Do I say that and hope I've drawn a reasonable parallel? Do I tell brave and talented Doris Buck, who never hurt anyone in her life, that we're paying dues for what our ancestors did, that we're reaping the terrible crop of pain and evil and murder committed in the name of white supremacy, that white men rob and rape and steal and kill as well as black, but that blacks are poorer, more desperate, more frustrated, angrier? Do I say that and hope to stop her tears with logic? Why the hell do we expect a nobility of blacks that whites never possessed? Of course I don't say that pack of simple-minded platitudes. Personal pain is incapable of spontaneous remission in the presence of loss. I say nothing. But my days of white liberal guilt are gone. My days of championing whole classes and sexes and pigmentations of people is gone. The 60s are gone, and we live in the terrible present, where death and guilt don't mix. Now I come, after all these years, to the only position that works. Each one on his or her own merits, black, white, yellow, brown, not all Jews are money-gouging kikes, but some are. Not all blacks are slavering rapists, but some are. Not all Puerto Ricans are midnight second-story spics, but some are. And we come to the question again and again, what kind of a God is it that permits such misery? Are we truly cast in his image, such an image of cruelty and rapaciousness, where we put here really to suffer such torment? Let the children of God answer that one with something other than no-brain jingoism. Mark Twain said, quote, if one truly believes there is an all-powerful deity, and one looks around at the condition of the universe, one is led inescapably to the conclusion that God is a malign thug. Unquote. That's the quote that caused me to write The Death Bird. It's a puzzle I cannot reason out. I doubt. I have always doubted since the day I read in the Old Testament, the Word of God, remember, that there was only Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and then Cain got married. To whom? To Eve? Then don't tell me what a no-no incest is. Isaac Asimov assures me it's a rational universe, predicated on sanity and order. Yeah, well, tell me about God. Tell me who he is, why he allows the foulest hyenas of our society to run amok while decent men and women cower in terror behind fox locks and dictograph systems. Tell me about him. Equate theology with the world in which we live, with William Calley and Kitty Genovese and the people who keep their kids out of school because the new textbooks dare to say humans are clever descendants of the ape. No? Having some trouble? Getting ready to write me a letter denouncing me as the Antichrist? God in his infinite wisdom, you say? Faith, you urge me? I have faith in people, not gods. But perhaps belief is not enough. Perhaps doubt serves the cause more honestly, more boldly. If so, I offer by way of faith, Pain God. Tears were impossible, yet tears were his heritage. Sorrow was beyond him, yet sorrow was his birthright. Anguish was denied him, even so, anguish was his stock in trade. For Trent, there was no unhappiness, nor was there joy, concern, discomfort, age, time, feeling. And this was as the ethos had planned it. For Trent had been appointed by the ethos, the race of somewhere, somewhen beings who morally and ethically ruled the universe, as their pain god. To Trent, who knew neither the tug of time nor the crippling demands of the emotions, fell the forever task of dispensing pain and sorrow to the myriad multitudes of creatures that inhabited the universes. Whether sentient or barely capable of the feeblest unicellular reaction formation, Trent passed along from his faceted cubicle, invisible against the backdrop of the changing stars. Unhappiness and misery in proportions too complexly arrived at to be verbalized. He was pain god for the universes, the one who dealt out the tears and the anguish and the soul-wrenching terrors that blighted life from its first moment to its last. Beyond age, beyond death, beyond feeling, lonely and alone in his cubicle, Trent went about his business without concern or pause. Trent was not the first pain god. There had been others. They had come before, not too many of them, but a few. And why they no longer held their post was a question Trent had never asked. He was the chosen one from a race that lived almost indefinitely, and his job was to pass along the calibrated and measured dollops of melancholy as prescribed by the ethos. It involved no feeling and no concern, only attention to duty. It was his position, and it was his obligation. How peculiar it was that he felt concern after all this time. It had begun so long before, and of time he had no conception, that the only marking date with validity was that in the great ocean soon to become the Gobi Desert, Paramecia, had become more prevalent than amoeba. It had grown in him through the centimetered centuries as layers and layers of forever settled down like mist to form the strata of the past. Now, it was now. Despite the strange ache in his nerve gland, his central nerve gland, despite the progressive dulling of his eye globes, despite the mad thoughts that spat and stuttered through his triple-domed cerebrum, thoughts of which he knew he was incapable, despite all this, Trent performed his now functions as he was required. He dispensed unbearable anguish to the residents of a third power planet in the Snail Cluster, supportable agony to a farm colony that had sprung up on Yakapetii U, incredible suffering to a parentless spider child on Heidig 9, and a relentless torment to a blameless race of mute aborigines on a nameless, arid planet circling a dying sun of the 707 system. And through it all, Trent suffered for his charges. What could not be, was. What could not come to pass, had. The soulless, emotionless, regimented creature that the Athos had named Pain God had contracted a sickness. Concern. At last, after centuries too filed away to unearth and codify, Trent had reached a now in which he could no longer support his acts. He cared. The physical manifestations of his mental upheaval were numerous. His oblong head throbbed, and his eye globes were dulling a little more each decade. The interlinked duodenal ulcers, so necessary to his endocrinal system's normal function, had begun to misfire like faulty plugs in an old car. The thwack of his salamander tail had grown weaker, indicating his motor responses to nerve endings were feebler. Trent, who had always been considered rather a handsome example of his race, had slowly come to look forlorn, weary, even a touch pathetic. And he sent down woe to an armored flying creature with a mite-sized brain on a dark planet at the edge of the coal sack. He dispatched fear and trembling to a smoke-like wraith that was the only visible remains of a great race that had learned to dispense with its bodies centuries before in the sun known as Vertal. He conscientiously winged terror and unhappiness and misery and sadness to a group of murdering pirates, a clique of shrewd politicians, and a brothelful of unregenerate whores, all on a fifth power planet of the White Horse constellation. Stopped alone there, in the night of space, his mind spiraling now for the first time down a strange and disquieting chamber of thought, Trent twisted within himself. I was selected because I lacked the certain difficulties I now manifest. What is this torment? What is this unpleasant, unhappy, unrelenting feeling that gnaws at me, tears at me, corrupts my thoughts, colors darkly my every desire? Am I going mad? Madness is beyond my race. It is a something we have never known. Have I been at this post too long? Have I failed in my duties? If there were a god stronger than the god that I am, or a god stronger than the Athos gods, then I would appeal to that god. But there is only silence in the night and the stars, and I'm alone, so God all alone here, doing what I must, doing my best. And then finally, I must know. While he spun a fiber of melancholy down to a double-thoraxed insect creature on Io, speared with dread a blob of barely sentient mud on Acarus 3, pain-goaded into suicide, an electrical wave being capable of producing exquisite 15-toned harmonics on Sindon Beta 5, reduced by half the pleasures of a pitiable slug thing in the methane caves of K-K-K-4, enshrouded in bitterness and misery a man named Colin Marshak on an insignificant planet called Sol 3, Earth, Terra, the world. And then finally, I will know. I will know. Trent removed the scale model of Earth from the display crate and stared at it. Such a tiny thing, such a helpless thing, to support the night walk of a pain god. He selected the most recent recipient of his attentions through no more involved method than that, and used the means of travel his race had long since perfected to leave his encased cubicle hanging translucent against the stars. Trent, pain god of the universes, for the first time in all the centuries he had lived that life of giving, never receiving, left his place and left his now and went to find out. To find out what? He had no way of knowing. For the pain god, it was the first night walk. Peter Kozlek had been born in a dwarf province of a minuscule Central European country, long since swallowed up by a tiny power, now a member of the common market. He had left Europe early in the 1920s, had shipped aboard a freighter to Bolivia, and, after working his way as a common deckhand and laborer through half a dozen banana republics, he had washed up on an inland shore of the United States in 1934. He had promptly gone to earth, gone to seed, and gone to fat. A short stint in a CCC camp, a shorter stint as a bouncer in a Kansas City speak, a term in the Illinois State Workhouse, a long run on the Pontiac assembly line making an obscure part for an obscure segment of a B-17's innards, a brief fling as an owner of a raspberry farm, and an extended period as a skid row frequenting wino, summed up his life. Now, as now would be reckoned by any sane man's ephemeris, Peter Kozlek was a wet brain, an alcoholic so sunk in the fumes and vapors of his own liquor need that he was barely recognizable as a human being. Lying soddenly but quietly in an alley two blocks up from the Greyhound bus station in downtown Los Angeles, Peter Kozlek, age 59, weight 210, hair filth gray, eyes red and moist and closed, unceremoniously died. That simply, that unconcernedly, that uneventfully for all the young old men in overlong GI surplus overcoats who passed by that alley, mouth unseeing, uncaring, Peter Kozlek died. His brain gave out. His lungs ceased to bellow. His heart refused to pump. His blood slid to a halt in his veins and breath no longer passed his lips. He died. End of story. Beginning of story. As he lay there, half propped against the brick wall with its shredded reminder of a lightweight boxing match between two stumble bums long since passed into obscurity and the files of Ring magazine, a thin, tepid vapor of pale green came to the useless body of Peter Kozlek, touched it, felt of it, entered it. Trent was on the planet Earth, Sol 3. If it had been possible to mount an epitaph on bronze for the wet brain, there on the wall of the alley, perhaps, the most fitting would have been, "Here lay Peter Kozlek. Nothing in his life became him so much as the leaving of it." The thick-bodied orator on the empty packing crate had gathered a sizable crowd. His license was encased in plastic, and it had been pinned to a broom handle, sharpened and driven into the ground. An American flag hung limply from a pole on the other side of the makeshift podium. The flag had only 48 stars. It had been purchased long before Hawaii or Alaska had joined the Union, but new flags cost money, and...
"Scum, like sewer water poured into your bloodstream. Look at them. Do they look like you? Do they smell like you? Those smells, those stinks that walk like men? That's what they are. Stinks with voting privileges. All of them, the niggers, the kike Jews who own the land and the apartments you live in, what they think they're big deals. The spicks, the Puerto Rican filth that takes over your streets and rapes your women and puts its lousy hands on your white young daughters. That scum.
Colin Marshak stood in the crowd, staring up at the thick-bodied orator, his shaking hands thrust deep into his sport jacket pockets, his head throbbing, the unlit cigarette hanging unnoticed from his lips. Every word.
Commies in public office is what we have got to be content with. Nigger lovers and pawns of the kike bastards who own the corporations. They want to kill all of you, all of us, every one of us. They want us to say, hey, come on, make love to my sister, to my wife, do all the dirty things that'll pollute my pure race. That's what the commies in public office, misusing our public trust, say to us. And what do we say in return? Back to them we say, no dice, dirty spies, lousy kikes, Puerto bastards, black men that want to steal our pure heritage. We say, go to hell to them. Go straight to hell, you dirty, rotten sons of...
At which point, the policeman moved quietly through the crowd, fascinated and silent like cobras at a mongoose convention, and arrested the thick-bodied orator. As they took him away, Colin Marshak turned and moved out of the milling group. Why is such hideousness allowed to exist? He thought bitterly, fearfully. He walked down the path and out of Pershing Square.
Pershing Square is where they have a fence up so the fruits can't pick the people.
And didn't even realize the roomy-eyed old man was following him till he was 6 blocks away. Then he turned, and the old man almost ran into him. Something I can do for you? Colin Marshak asked. The old man grinned feebly, his pale gums exposing themselves above gap-toothed ruin.
No, sir. No, sir. I was just following along to see maybe I could tap you for a couple cents to get some chicken noodle soup. It's kind of cold, and I thought maybe...
Colin Marshak's wide, somehow humorous face settled into understanding lines. You're right, old man. It's cold, and it's windy, and it's miserable, and I think you're entitled to some goddamn chicken noodle soup. God knows someone's entitled. He paused a beat, added, maybe me. He took the old man by the arm, seemingly unaware of the rancid, rotting condition of the cloth. They walked along the street outside the park and turned into one of the many side routes littered with one-arm beaneries and 40-cent-a-night flop houses. And possibly a hot roast beef sandwich with gravy all over the French fries, Colin added, steering the wine-smelling old derelict into a restaurant. Over coffee and a bear claw, Colin Marshak stared at the old man. Hey, what's your name?
Peter Kozlik.
The old man murmured, hot vapors from the thick white coffee mug rising up before his watery eyes.
I've been kind of sick, you know.
Too much sauce, old man, said Colin Marshak. Too much sauce does it for a lot of us. My father and mother both. Nice folk, loved each other. They went to the old Alki's home hand in hand. It was touching.
You're kind of feeling sorry for yourself, ain't you?
Said Peter Kozlik, and looked down at the coffee hurriedly. Colin stared across angrily. Had he sunk that low, that quickly, that even the seediest cockroach-ridden bum in the gutter could snipe at him, talk up to him, see his sad and sorry state? He tried to lift his coffee cup, and the cream-laced liquid sloshed over the rim, over his wrist. He yipped and set the cup down quickly.
Your hands shake worse than mine, mister, Peter Kozlik noted.
It was a curious tone, somehow devoid of feeling or concern, more a statement of observation.
Yeah, my hands shake, Mr. Kozlik, sir.
They shake because I make my living cutting things out of stone. And for the past 2 years, I've been unable to get anything from stone but tidy piles of rock dust. Kozlik spoke around a mouthful of cruller.
You're one of them statue makers. What I mean, a
sculptor.
That is precisely what I am, Mr. Kozlek, sir. I am a capturer of exquisite beauty in rock and plaster and quartz and marble. The only trouble is I'm no damned good. And I was never ever really very good, but at least I made a decent living selling a piece here and there and conning myself into thinking I was great and building a career. And Canada in the Times said a few nice things about me, but even that's turned to rust now. I can't make a chisel do what I want it to do. I can't sand, and I can't chip, and I can't carve dirty words on sidewalks if I try. Peter Kozlek stared across at Colin Marshak, and there was a banked fire down in those roomy, sad old eyes. He watched and looked and saw the hands shaking uncontrollably, saw them ring one against another like mad things, and even when interlocked, they still trembled hideously. And Trent, locked within an alien shell, comprehended a small something. This creature of puny carbon atoms and other substances that could not exist for an instant in the rigorous arena of space was dying. Inside, it was ending its life cycle because of the misery Trent had sent down. Trent had been responsible for the quivering pain that sent Colin Marshak's hands into spasms. It had been done 2 years before, by Colin Marshak's time, but only a few moments earlier, as Trent knew it. And now, it had changed this creature's life totally. Trent watched the strange human being, a product of little introverted needs and desires, and he knew he must go farther, must experiment further with his problem. The green and transparent vapor that was Trent seeped out of the eyes of Peter Kozlek and slid carefully inside Colin Marshak. It left itself wide open, flung itself wide open to what tremors governed the man, and Trent felt the full impact of the pain he so lightly dispensed to all the living things in the universes. It was potent, hot all, and it was a further knowing, a greater knowledge, a simple act that the sickness had compelled him to undertake. By the fear and the memory of all the fears that had gone before, Trent knew, and knowing, had to go farther. For he was Pain God, not a transient tourist in the country of pain. He drew forth the mind of Marshak, of that weak and trembling Colin Marshak, and fled with it, out there, farther, much farther, till time came to a slithering halt and space was no longer of any consequence, and he whirled Colin Marshak through the universes, through the infinite allness of the space and time and motion and meaning that was the crevice into which life had sunk itself. He saw the blobs of mud and the whirling winged things and the tall humanoids and the cleat-treaded half-men, half-machines that ruled one and another sector of open space. He showed it all to Colin Marshak, drenched him in wonder, filled him like the most vital goblet the ethos had ever created, poured him full of love and life and the staggering beauty of the cosmos. And having done that, he whirled the soul and spirit of Colin Marshak down, down, and down to the fibrous shell that was his body and poured that soul back inside. Then he walked the shell to the home of Colin Marshak and turned it loose and... When the sculptor awoke, lying face down amidst the marble chips and powder-fine dust of the statue, he saw the base first, and not having recalled even buying a chunk of stone that large, raised himself on his hands and his knees and his haunches and sat there, and his eyes went up toward the summit and seemed to go on forever, and when he finally saw what it was he had created, this thing of such incredible loveliness and meaning and wisdom, he began to sob. Softly, never very loud, but deeply, as though each whimper was drawn from the very core of him. He had done it this once, but as he saw his hands still trembling, still murmuring to themselves in spasms, he knew it was the one time he would ever do it, There was no memory of how or why or even of when, but it was his work. Of that he was certain. The pain in his wrists told him it was. The moment of truth stood high above him, resplendent in marble, but there would be no other moments. This was Colin Marshak's life, in its totality, now. The sound of sobbing was only broken periodically as he began to drink. Waiting. The Ethos waited. Trent had known they would. It was inevitable. Foolish for him to conceive of a situation of which they would not have an awareness. Away. From your post. Away. I had to know. It has been growing in me, a live thing in me. I had to know it was the only way. I went to a planet and lived within what they call men and knew. I think I understand now. No. What is it you know? I know that pain is the most important thing in the universes, greater than survival, greater than love, greater even than the beauty it brings about. For without pain there can be no pleasure, without sadness there can be no happiness, without misery there can be no beauty, and without these life is endless, hopeless, doomed, and damned. Adult. You have become adult. I know this is what became of the other pain gods before me. They grew into concern, into knowing, and then lost. They were lost to us. They could not take the step. They could not go to one of the ones to whom they had sent pain and learned, so they were no use as pain god. I understand. Now I know, and I am returned. Do. What will you do? I will send more pain than ever before. More and greater. More, you will send more? Much more. Because now I understand. It is a gray and a lonely place in which we live, all of us, swinging between desperation and emptiness, and all that makes it worthwhile as caring is beauty. But if there were no opposite for beauty or for pleasure, it would all turn to dust. Being. Now you know who you are. I am most blessed of the Ethos, and most humble. You have given me the highest, kindest position in the universes, for I am the god to all men and to all creatures, small and large, whether they call me by name or not. I am pain god, and it is my life, however long it stretches, to treat them to the finest they will ever know. To give them pain, that they may know pleasure. Thank you. And the Ethos went away, secure that at last, after all the eons of pain gods who had broken under the strain, who had lacked the courage to take that night walk, they had found one who would last truly forever. Trent had come of age. While back in the cubicle, hanging star bright and translucent in space, high above it all, yet very much part of it all, the creature who would never die, the creature who had lived within the rotting body of Peter Kozlek and for a few moments in the soul and talent of Colin Marshak, that creature called Pain God learned one more thing as he stared at the tiny model of the planet Earth he had known. Trent knew the feel of a tear formed in a duct and turned free from an eye globe, cool on his face. Trent knew happiness.